The following program is for entertainment and basic informational purposes only. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of Cumulus Media, WPRV Radio, its management, or staff. This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
And we welcome you to, the first really hot day here. And I decided what a perfect day, especially with no heat in our studio. No air conditioning in our studio. What a great day to invite a guest to be on the radio show. It's especially a guest who just loves. Actually, I think he did a TV program with Dan York, and I don't think they had any heat in their studio either, did they?
No heat.
Jordan Goodman, that's the voice you're hearing on the other microphone over here. Jordan is a local guy, so it's not like, we dragged him in from California somewhere, although that may have been his last stop, but he is definitely a local guy. And okay, before we even get into all the broad-based introductions about, who is this guy and why do we want to listen to him? Why are you in town? You're coming to Rhode Island. You picked a great weekend to come.
I did. I went to Moses Brown School and grew up in Cranston. And I'm class of 1972. So we're having our 45th reunion this weekend. The class was maybe about 80, and we're going to get, 40 or 50 of them back, a lot of people. So I've got deep roots in Rhode Island and love to help people here. And so, but basically, I'm in New York, and I was at Money Magazine for 18 years. I've done 14 books. I'm on Fox and CNN and CNBC and all those things all the time. But I feel at home being here on your show.
Well, financial talk probably let me put it the other way. Just as I did, you grew up with financial talk.
Absolutely.
And it's because of financial talk that you even have something to do every day. You write a book, and because of the increasing popularity of financial television, financial radio, financial online services, the demand for somebody who could be on, rather than listening with earphones, but actually to pick up a book and have it in your hand while you're reading it on a plane.
Yeah. Well, I've done several. The first book I did is called The Dictionary of Finance and Investment Terms. It actually came out in 1983. That's how long I've been doing this.
Wow.
And that's now in its ninth edition. And just the language alone can be really intimidating to a lot of people in this field. So that just explains all the language very simply.
Well, when I started doing the Money Talk program back in 91, which is a little bit after you, but back in those days, myself at the time doing a lot of financial planning, but nobody really knew what that was.
Yeah.
When you said, your financial planner, they said, I know a guy that works for Dayvol or works for Textron. He's a financial planner. Well, they had planners, but they were financial guys. They were chief financial officers. And
what happens
world.
Is, unfortunately, there's still a lot of financial literacy in this country and in Rhode Island because they're not teaching it in schools. A little bit, but nothing close to what's necessary. And the result is people get to a job and say, here's this packet. With 50 choices in your 401k, you figure it out. It's like, people are like, what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to do that?
Well, it's funny. One of my producers back in the old days, it was in 1992, after he came to me and he said, look, I talked to a lot of people who say they heard the show or they listened to this, and it's what it's becoming clear is that you will use terminology sometimes,
mm-hmm.
or you'll talk about ideas and strategies. And what's the point of telling people how to dollar cost average into mutual funds if they actually don't know what a mutual fund is?
Yeah. Well, they don't get taught that in schools. You learn all about Roman pottery and Greek literature and wonderful things, but dollar cost averaging is something they'll never. In fact, I speak on campuses a lot, and I was going to one campus recently to say, I should speak to your students. I'd head to the head of the economics department. And I described what I do. He said, what you're doing is too relevant. That's the exact word he read. He said, it's not academically rigorous enough. I said, this is the actual life.
Too relevant.
That's the word he said, too relevant. We are academic here. We are above relevance.
Somebody's going to graduate from high school this year.
Yes.
And either they're already doing it or in the next week or two. And they're going to walk out and they're going to get their first real job.
And their first paycheck,
right? And if they're not going on to college, but whether they do or they're graduating from college, but they're going to get out and get that first real job, and somebody from HR or the clerk is going to come up to them and hand them a package and say, okay, fill out all this information. By the way, we have a company 401k plan.
Yeah.
Fill in the information and get it back to me by the end of the week, and we'll set you up. And they look at you.
Maybe they do it, but they have no clue about how to allocate the money. Or they'll do it, and they'll never look at it for another 30 years.
Well, the point is, though, that they're going to be asked to make financial decisions the day they start getting a real paycheck.
Right.
And they're going to have to start making, creating some sort of, even if it's an informal strategy, about how to live.
Right.
And they don't know how to deal with credit, with debt, with investment, with savings.
You see the results of financial illiteracy is that the amount of debt people are getting into. The numbers just came out from the Federal Reserve last week, $12.7 trillion in debt, all-time record high. People are going into a lot of debt, all credit card debt, student loan debt, auto loan debt, mortgage debt. You know, and it's because they're illiterate financially, basically.
Now, I've looked back at your list of credits, some of the book, like you said, you've written probably
14 books. Right.
And you know, and a lot of that stuff has dealt almost focusing on the fact that people don't know how to handle debt.
Correct. Debt's a big thing. So, I mean, let's just do something on that to begin with. So on credit card debt, we're now over $1 trillion in credit card debt. The average rate's about 13%, something like that. And people are really stressing out on it. Roughly 40% of the people who have credit card debt revolve the balances every month. They do not pay it off in full. And roughly 60% do pay it off in full. So the people who are at 40%, that's very expensive money because your money's sitting in the savings account earning zero. If you're paying 13% on average and sometimes 18 or 25%, it's really, really expensive.
Jordan, do they even know, or how many of them actually know that their rate is 13 on that credit card?
Well, it says it, but they might not look at it.
I don't pay attention to it. I remember one woman was saying, she says, well, you know, I took advantage of one of those opportunity things, and I got in at I got 1.3%.
Yeah.
So I remember sitting with her when we were talking. I said, well, bring me in the statement.
Yes.
And we look at the thing, and I'm looking. I said, wait a minute, right over here in the fine print over here, you're paying 16.4.
1.3 must have been an introductory offer that expired.
Well, either that or actually it turned out later on because I asked her to call the 800 number. They said, how is it possible that I ended up going from the open that special rate to some ridiculous rate? Turns out she was late, 2 days late.
That's right.
With one payment.
That'll do it.
2 days late. And then it's like the contract ended. You screwed up.
What they call the default rate. That's correct.
But she didn't know.
Yeah. Well, they're not going to make a big deal.
She still thought she was getting a pretty good deal.
So let me give two specific. I always like to give specific advice, Don. So two things. Get better credit cards. You don't have to put up with these ridiculous ones. A free website to get the best credit card is guidetocreditcard.com. Free website. Get the best deals for your spending habits. So if you want to take trips, pile up your spending on a frequent flyer card. If you want to go to Disney World, get a Disney card or whatever it may be. If you want cash back, there are about 5 and 6% cash rewards you can get. If you had bad credit in the past, use what's called a secured card. You put up a certain dollar amount, $1,000. They'll give you a $1,000 credit line, and then if you don't pay them back, they've already got your money. But if you do responsible payment over time, you can kind of graduate to a secured card.
Now, that, Jordan, is the answer to the when somebody questions you and says, okay, look, I'm told I can't get a credit card. I've never had one, or I think I got lousy credit. How do I start? How do I start getting a credit record?
Right. That's the way to do it, is to reestablish, if not establish in the first place, because they've already got your money. So if you don't pay, they've already got your money, so they're not taking any risk that way.
Now, if they don't learn, and I imagine, like you said, most high schools, when you hear the term, they have a home economics class, it has nothing to do with economics.
No.
But it's making cookies and how to. Actually, I learned how to sew a button on a shirt.
Oh, good.
And it turned out to be pretty
useful.
That's a
good thing to know.
But it never occurred to me that nobody was actually saying, "We're going to teach you how to balance a checkbook.
Right.
We're going to teach you what is a credit card. I mean, what is the nature of it?" And then later on, of course, especially if colleges in their minds, now they're dealing with something that is near and dear to your heart, and that's student loans.
What other thing can a 17-year-old? What other trouble can get into but taking on student loans? Tens of thousands of dollars a year, and they don't even have their first. They don't even know what. Never mind their first job. They don't even know what field they're going into yet.
You know what I'd like to do? We're going to take a quick break here.
Alrighty.
When we come back, Jordan Goodman, we'd like to talk a little bit about either the frequently asked questions or the misconceptions about student loan and debt.
Absolutely,
folks. This is the Money Talk program with Don Sowa and Jordan Goodman sitting here in studio. We're going to be right back, right here on AM 790. your home of talking business.
This is Money Talk with Don Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we're back. Part two of tonight's Money Talk program. Delighted to have you here during your drive time home. In studio with me, Mr. Jordan Goodman, a graduate 1972.
Correct.
Moses Brown. Not Brown. I was going to say Brown University.
My father was a professor at Brown.
Oh, there
That's
we go. There's a lot of Brown going on out there. But Moses Brown, back when he used to be on the swim team and had to swim where?
Johnson and Wales
had a swimming pool.
Okay. We didn't have the Brown pool in those days, yes.
Well, I'll tell you, like we mentioned off before we got on, my brother graduated just a couple of years before you did from Moses Brown also.
Yeah.
But a lot of stuff going on this weekend here in Rhode Island, because anybody was listening to Broadwin's show before us, you got water fires starting
Sounds
up in the city.
Great.
And
yeah.
You couldn't have more beautiful weather for this
it's
weekend.
Hot.
And
hot.
My wife's a PC grad, and as is my daughter Donna, who does the Tuesday program here with me. It's called Get Back to Basics.
Great.
And that's what we started doing. We started talking earlier on that after 1 year on the air, a producer said, there are a lot of people out there who really need something really, really basic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the things you talk about are interesting, but they said, well, that's all great, but I don't even know what a mutual fund is. So I in my own arrogance at the time, I said, I'm going to have to design a program. So every Tuesday, I called it Get Back to Basics.
Excellent.
And it was as basic as the difference between a stock and a bond.
Good. People need it.
But back in those days, nobody knew the difference. So and I didn't want to sound like I was condescending or talking down to anybody.
People don't feel uncomfortable even asking sometimes.
It became the most popular show of
That's
the
great.
Week.
When I did this dictionary, people they feel intimidated to even ask what these terms mean, like dollar cost averaging or something.
Something struck me, Jordan, when you were talking about debt. You talk about credit card debt.
Yes.
And I said, well, there's another category of debt that's broken through that magic $1 trillion mark, isn't there?
Student loans is up to $1.3
trillion. Wow.
We're going through the graduations right now. And by the time this graduation season is over, it's another $100 billion in student loan debt. We'll be up to $1.4 trillion soon. And it's just crushing people. The average student is graduating with $38,000 in student loan debt. The total amount, as you said, $1.4 trillion. And these are 30-year loans for people who haven't gotten their first jobs yet. Luckily, the environment is pretty good for getting jobs. The average salary is about $50,000. But over 50% of the people who are graduating are going back and living at home again because they don't have the money to rent an apartment, buy a car, start a family, do all the things that normal people would do in past generations.
So mom and dad never really had the chance to be empty nesters, as they used to call it.
Well, I call them the boomerang generation. They keep coming back, yes.
Yeah, well, I always thought about that issue of being in the sandwich generation, where all of a sudden we are responsible for our elder parents, and now our children below us.
I call the parents the reverse boomerangers, because that's when the parents move back with the kids. And then the kids moving back with the parents as the boomerangers. So, yeah, you're right. It's the sandwich generation, people being squeezed both sides. So
how are they paying for it, Jordan? I mean, really, seriously? I mean, they're getting out, and the jobs they're getting aren't going to be so outrageously generous that they could easily cover that that debt.
Well, that's why they can't. Even if they're earning the average, which is $50,000 to get started, they don't have enough to pay rent, buy a car, do all the things they would normally do and have a life. So that's why they live at home in many cases. So, there are some things they can do. The first thing they can do is consolidate. If they got a whole bunch of federal loans at different interest rates, the federal consolidation program allows you to have it all in one at the lowest possible interest rate. There's a website for that, consolidatecollege.com, that can help you go through that because you really want to at least simplify it to some extent. And a lot of people don't realize, Don, you can actually refinance student loans to as low as 2 to 3%. So you combine federal loans, which may be like in the 4 to 5% range, and private loans, which could be 8 to 10% or higher, into one at 2 to 3% and save yourself a lot of money that way. A website for that is credible.com, C-R-E-D-I-B-L-E, credible.com, and they put /money answers. They know it's me. That way you get $200 off your first payment. And they basically have 5 or 6 different lenders, and you see which is the best deal for you. So it'll help a little bit.
And they'll run the numbers for you.
Right.
You give them all
you see what your credit score is and how much debt you've got and the interest rates you've got. And then these lenders are kind of competing to get your business.
All right. Well, for the person listening to this for the first time, the difference between that federal loan and the private loan.
So a federal loan is subsidized by the government, and it's issued by – it used to be through banks backed by the federal government. But in 2009, they changed the system. So it really is directly from the Department of Education, actually. So that's where they're federal loans. So it's a lower interest rate. But there's certain rules about it that you got to, if you get behind, they can be pretty angry, and they will garnish your wages, they'll take your tax refund, they'll do all kinds of things. But the result is it's a lower interest rate. And parents, or what are called the parent plus loans, is maybe a point or so higher, same kind of thing. And there's limits on how much they'll do. And then private loans would be not through the federal. That would be like a bank loan or something, typically going to be a higher interest rate than the federal loans.
Now, the potential obligation that you or the co-signer on any of these loans might have is different for the federal loan versus the private bank loan?
Well, I mean, typically the federal loans cannot be discharged in bankruptcy.
I see.
In 2005, they changed the bankruptcy laws and said that there are two kinds of debt you cannot get rid of even in bankruptcy, student loans and IRS debt.
Oh, there you go.
You'll take it to the grave with you. So, but whereas private loans, you can settle for less than the full amount, whereas you can't really do that with federal loans.
So you got an entire generation of people moving into this world, the adult world, carrying all of this debt.
Right.
And are they depending on those trillions of dollars they keep talking about changing hands from one generation to another? They're hoping that they can inherit the money to pay off the loan?
Maybe, but not a good strategy. Because what's happening is their parents are going to live longer, and they may get an inheritance, but it's going to be much further down the road. And, I mean, I think Obama actually paid off his student loans by age 53, something like that. I mean, people are paying it off 30 years later. So unless you get some windfall, which I wouldn't count on, people have what I call white knight syndrome. It's thinking, okay, I've got all these bad habits, but this one lottery ticket will change everything or something.
Oh.
Don't count on it. Okay, you may win, but most people lose, actually.
So now you got a group of older folks who are out there working in the real world, struggling and wrestling with that $1 trillion plus of credit card debt.
Right.
And then you get their kids who are now young adults coming out of school, and they're struggling with an entirely new generation of debt that
Correct.
That most of us wouldn't fully understand.
When I went to Amherst College in Massachusetts, it was $4,000 a year.
All right.
And now it's $67,000.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, my daughter is 14 years ago, she graduated from Providence College.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember I was paying, as part of a payment plan they had, that I could pay $2,000 a month for 10 months. It was $20,000 a year.
And what is PC now?
It's like 56, 50.
Yeah.
It's over. It depends on whether you're living there or not.
Yeah.
But, I mean,
yeah.
It's the numbers are so high that I keep showing you my naivete because I'm not as involved with that world. I'm thinking, well, that's got to be MIT or Harvard or Princeton. No.
There's 150 colleges over 60,000. And some are now getting over 70,000. Sarah Lawrence recently went over 70,000 a year, for example.
Now, I mean, how many people that apply to a school who are talking to the finance department, how many actually end up paying that kind of the big money that they quote you? I mean,
everything's negotiable.
Yeah.
Everything is negotiable.
If they really want you.
If they really want you, there are scholarships. There's a ways of getting it down. Hardly anybody pays the kind of retail price, but it takes a lot of negotiation. Sometimes you may have to do something. You may have to do a work study or clean dishes or, you know, clean up the labs. I mean, there may be some ways, but it's worth it. Now, obviously, the best solution is to save up front so you don't have to borrow as much when you get there. And that's what, I mean, people do a little bit, but, you know, the numbers we're talking about, nothing close to what they need. I mean, if you're $60,000 a year, I mean, I'm sure Brown is well over $60,000 a year. You're talking about $240,000 for 4 years. I mean,
and most of these are kids, if you talk to them, honestly. I was talking to one young fellow who wanted to go get a degree in engineering, and he's thinking of going, he wants to go to MIT.
Yeah.
So I asked him, he was in with his father in the office. I said, when you graduate with your undergraduate degree in chemical or mechanical engineering, I said, the job that you think you want, the career you're looking for, is that going to require a graduate degree?
Probably.
He goes, are you aware that URI has a pretty damn good engineering department?
Yeah.
And you live in North Kingstown?
Yes.
You can commute. You can probably go to 4 years. And by the way, if you're good enough to get good grades there, you're going to save your parents a hell of a lot of money.
Right.
And then maybe if you are lucky, you get into graduate school at MIT. And I promise you, your boss is not going to look down and say, he's got a master's in engineering. Oh, but he went to URI for undergraduate. I said, don't think of that because
no.
URI is no longer the backup school.
Correct. Correct. Well, and what's happening is because the private schools are so expensive, a lot of people who in previous generations would have gone to private school are now going to public schools.
Yeah.
And so the public school student population has gotten much, much better because people want to pay an in-school tuition. I mean, what is URI these days? 20,000 or something like that?
Something pretty close.
Yeah. So, and that's the cheap alternative, right?
But they would rather have the kid come in instead of going to Rutgers, have him come from New Jersey, come to Rhode Island and pay the big money.
Exactly. So, but I'm just saying, they get a perfectly good education, and where the real need is technical education. And there's a tremendous shortage of people to be plumbers, electricians, utility linemen, computer coders, all these kind of things.
Ladies and gentlemen, the voice you're listening to, that's Jordan Goodman. He is a financial author, speaker, traveler, and, of course, a Moses Brown grad. He's
Absolutely.
In town for that, and he's here with us on Money Talk here tonight. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some things that are a little bit more topical and talked about the idea of emotion as part of your decision-making and why people are nervous all of a sudden here in 2017, and does it matter? We'll be right back with more Money Talk.
This is Money Talk with Don Soa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we're back with the Money Talk program, everybody. I'm Don Soa. For those of you who are new to the show, we are your financial talk program during the drive time here at AM 790. And it is the longest running financial talk program in the universe. Or actually, I was talking to my guest, Jordan Goodman, who has actually been on as a guest actually a number of times with some friends of ours who were the longest running financial talk program forever, and that of course was Ken and Daria Dolan.
I actually subbed for the Dolans. I was the only one they would let actually sub for them.
Yeah, that one, they were on WOR radio out of New York for like forever.
Right.
And they were certainly, you know, doing books and touring, and we hosted them when they came up here to Rhode Island.
They were great. Mm-hmm.
They were doing their speaking event. And Jordan's been a guest as well as a co-host for them, subbing in when the Dolans are on the road, when they were
Correct.
In during that period of time.
Correct.
Now, did you ever ask, I mean, having been doing this long enough, did you ever ask yourself, or did anybody ever ask you, what do you think is the most important thing you talk about? Is there any one topic that you find that is not just interesting, Jordan, but the most important thing you talk about?
I think one of the most important things in today's market is earning a decent yield on your money. Because a lot of people, there's about $10 trillion sitting in CDs, money market funds, earning zero, basically. And that's a real shame. People should not have their money earning zero, but they don't know what to do. They're afraid. So I like to talk about ways to earn decent yields on your money without taking huge amounts of risk. Because a lot of people have what I call dormant money sitting there.
Well, even with historically low inflation, they still have a negative interest
Correct.
Rate at the bank.
Correct. Yeah, because there may be fees, but officially inflation is 2%, but a lot of people's expenses going up way more than that. So let me just talk about some ways to do that, because I think that might be of interest to the audience. One of the things I do are what are called commercial mortgage bridge loans as a way of earning 6% very safely over 1 year. You get monthly checks. At the end of the 1 year, you get your money back. There's a website for that, commercialmortgagebridgeloans.com. And what they're doing is lending money short-term to commercial projects that use it to renovate or improve some kind of commercial property, a retail store, a office building, a student loan housing, whatever it may be.
So who are the people that are underwriting these loans?
So there's a loan originator that puts the deals together. So you're, in effect, the lender. And then the loan originator brings the borrower in and vets the whole deal. The maximum they lend on the property is 65% loan to value.
Okay.
So there's kind of what I call.
So if they default on it, you get more than your money back if you have to.
Correct, which is very, very rare. But if there's what I call the equity cushion is that 35%, and it's over 1 year. People are borrowing this money to improve their projects, not to lose their projects.
Mm.
So the default rate is very, very low. And even the loan originators, in many cases, take a second position behind you. So if there is a default or not late payment, they're in a position to kind of take care of it and make sure you get your money. So there's a very safe way to get 6% in pretty much a 0% world for 1 year.
Now, in fairness, though, Jordan, there are a number of, and I know that you work with and are very familiar with, a number of different types of strategic income programs
mm-hmm.
that will generate comfortably within 4 to 6%, as you've mentioned, but
they're volatile.
The listeners got to understand they're not. If their familiarity with a higher level of return is going from a 3-year to a 5-year CD, they're still thinking FDIC. They think safety. They think FDIC.
Yeah, I mean, even 5-year, you're not going to get 1% today.
No, you're not.
I mean, remember the 10-year Treasury. It's 2.2 today, so a 5-year CD is not going to be. I wouldn't lock my money in for 5 years on a CD.
So if a person is going to be looking for some of these alternative income programs, they you if you were thinking as that person's advisor, you'd say, let's take some piece of your income pie.
Right, either your bond or cash portfolio that you don't need, because you are tying your money up for a year. If you go out longer, if you go out 2 years, you might get 8%. If you go out 3 years, you might get 9%. So there's a series
of
things.
So keep enough of ladder at peak, like the bucket plan. Have
exactly.
enough money to cover your current short-term needs, and then this will be part of your longer-term. Like you said, you're locking it up for a year.
You are. Locking up, I mean, a year one, 6%, 2 years, 8%, 3 years, 9%, that kind of thing. And there's a little video that explains all this. Again, that website, commercialmortgagebridgeloans.com. That's something that you're not going to hear about from your local bank or broker.
And there's a lot. Honestly, I go to a number of meetings with the financial planning community, and the first time I ever heard of that was reading your book.
Good.
You know,
I give you new things.
I had, well, I mean, I'd heard of it, but I couldn't say. If somebody said, well, what is that? And I'd say, I could kind of guess.
I mean, the reason it's so popular is after the financial crisis, you had the Dodd-Frank bill come in.
Yeah.
And they put tremendous strictures on the bank, making it really hard to make traditional commercial loans like this. So you have to have all kinds of collateral, and it takes 6 months to 9 months. It takes a long time. This, for the borrower, is very quick. They can get their money in two weeks or something like that. And it's made mostly on the value of the property, not the creditworthiness of the borrower.
Right.
And that's why they can do it so quick. So people want to get on with their lives and do their projects, and this allows them to do it. So in a certain way, it's kind of a byproduct of what I think is the overregulation from Dodd-Frank.
Now, you yourself has taken on the role of the educator.
Right.
Especially since you focused a lot, I mean, from the stuff I've read that you've written, a lot of attention on the variety of alternative income-producing investment programs.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about, in addition to that one, which mm-hmm. you mentioned, which I know is one of your favorites.
It is.
There is a hierarchy of investments that a great many of our listeners may also not be aware of, starting with perhaps the most conservative, but the entry level, and then working your way right up to the one you just talked about.
Well, another one would be what are called master limited partnerships, MLPs. Those are publicly traded, yield 4 to 5%, something like that. I mean, they can move around a little bit. Basically, what they do is they do energy infrastructure. So they put in pipelines, storage facilities, tankers, things like that, to get the oil and gas from the fields to the refineries. Putting it very simply.
Yeah.
So their model is a toll road model. They put in these pipes, and they collect money for having oil and gas flow through the pipes. It's not based on the price of oil and gas. It just is oil and gas flowing. So it's a very conservative model. I'll give you some names of some of my favorites. Enterprise Products Partners, EPD, Magellan Midstream Partners, MPP. Those are two examples.
Well, probably among the better known ones, Kinder Morgan might have been among a very well known one.
Now, they switched from MLP to a corporation.
Yeah, they did. They went public.
They had been an MLP for a long time, but they switched to a corporate.
But they were all struggling during a time when regulation was choking some of them.
Correct.
And now all of a sudden, again,
I hate to get,
we don't get overly political, but under the current administration, there's some movement towards less regulation, and these types of investments may be the beneficiaries of
that. So, for example, the Keystone XL pipeline, which had been blocked by Obama, is going through under Trump. That's going to help these pipeline companies to move more oil and gas. So, I mean, they're very good. In many cases, they raise their dividends. Enterprise Products, I mentioned, has raised its dividend every quarter for, I think it's like 10 years straight, something like that. So it's a way of getting rising income. The only thing is they are interest rate sensitive,
mm-hmm.
positively negative. When interest rates go up, they can go down. When interest rates go down, they can go up. So there's a bit of interest rate sensitivity. But that's another alternative that's also instantly liquid. You can get in and out of it whenever you like, as any stock. The commercial mortgage bridge loans is not liquid. It's designed to lock your money up for a year or two.
Now, are there pooled assets out there for the person who doesn't want to go out and try to do all that research and find the individual property or the individual holding, but like, say, an exchange-traded fund type thing where there's a basket of these master limited partnerships or basket?
Oh, yeah, sure. There's an ETF. There's one called AMLP, which
okay.
is the Alerian Mass Limited Partnership ETF. I think they've got 50 MLPs in there. So in one stock, one of the things about MLPs is you get a K-1 every year, which
right.
is a kind of a pain of a tax form.
Sure.
Because part of the distribution is taxable. Some of it's considered return of capital, so it's not taxable. So it gets a little bit complicated.
And actually, the pain in the neck side of that is some of the thing that some of the individuals like about it, which is why they invest in the first place.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but I'm just saying when you do an AMLP, it's a fund. There's no K-1s. It's just regular income. You get a regular 1099 or something like
now,
that.
Now, in the same category, again, in with individual holdings versus potentially either a mutual fund or an ETF, what is the difference from an income perspective of a common stock that pays a dividend and, say, a preferred stock?
So a preferred stock moves far less than a common stock. Preferred stock, what preferred means is in the case of liquidation, preferred shareholders get their money back before common shareholders. A recent example, when General Motors went bankrupt in 2009, the preferred shareholders were protected. The common shareholders got wiped out. That's kind of an example. That's what preferred means. But that's a pretty unusual situation. But basically, the preferred shareholders, the preferred shares are issued at $25 a share. And might fluctuate from, you know, 23 to 27 or something like that, or hardly at all.
So the share price doesn't move all that much.
Very little. But in return for that, you get a higher yield, 5, 6%, whereas the common shares of the same company are going to have much more volatility and a lower yield. So it's a trade-off between higher yield and less volatility.
I can remember many years ago a very, very popular, actually even locally popular because I heard people talking about it, was the Royal Bank of Scotland.
Yes, RBS.
And they paid a 7% dividend, yet their total return over an average 10-year period was around 9.
Yeah.
So the share price would go up maybe 2%, but the 7 of it was...
RBS went down. I mean, they had a horrible... Didn't they own, I think, Citizens Bank?
Citizens Bank locally,
right?
Yeah.
But they had a horrible, they almost went bankrupt, and that was a very bad situation.
But this was, like I said, that's why I mentioned it was several years back.
Yeah.
And I thought, I says, the people that own them, because I had a client come in who owned a fairly good amount of it, and in an effort to try to diversify his portfolio, I was suggesting that we should sell off part of that.
Yeah.
But he was attached to it emotionally because it was so boring. He says, I'm getting 7% dividend, and it's maybe varies 2% maybe capital appreciation.
Yeah, well, that's what a preferred's about. That's what a preferred's about. Typically, the preferreds are offered by highly rated corporations, banks, insurance companies, utilities. Those would be the three big areas. And there's actually an ETF for preferreds. The symbol is PFF.
Right. So you can remember that one, folks, right?
PFF. And that's like 50 different preferreds. Instead of buying individual ones, you get a diversified portfolio with a yield of about 4%.
So there's a what is technically would be listed as an equity portfolio, except you'll notice it pays a pretty darn high dividend.
Correct.
And there are also mutual funds out there that specialize in not only stocks that pay dividends, but companies that have a history of increasing the dividend every year for a decade.
These are what are called dividend growth funds. So Vanguard's got one, Fidelity's got one. So the strategy is to buy companies that raise their dividends consistently. I'll give you one example. Johnson & Johnson has raised its dividend for, whatever, 100 years straight or something like that. When you raise your dividend, it means you've got the earnings to support it. So it generally is a good sign that the company is doing well, and you get rising dividends.
Now, Jordan, when we come back in, I realize this. If anybody wants to know the broad spectrum of your interests and the topics that you embrace, that you think are important, so you certainly write about them, you do research on them, they can certainly purchase your books. Is there a place to go with just a list of those books?
Well, yeah, my website is moneyanswers.com. I'm the Money Answers man, so moneyanswers.com.
Is that all one word, Money Answers?
All one word, moneyanswers.com. Loads of resources, links, videos, all kinds of things, and all of my books are in my
Frequently
bookstore.
Asked questions?
Frequently asked. I've got FAQs as well, you bet.
Everything in there. Well, when we come back from this break, what I'd like to do is, obviously, because this is 2017, what's unique about 2017?
All right.
The world is changing. At
yes,
least
it is.
Our world is changing here in the United States. And I would like to be, especially a guy who spends a lot of time with your ear to the ground.
Yes.
Listening to the direction the trains are coming in and figure out, how big a deal in your mind as a person who studies money is the political environment that we're in?
Be glad to discuss that.
I mean, let's face it. I mean, everybody's asking their financial advisor out there, should I be worried about what's happening in Washington? You should pay attention.
Yes,
guess who's paying attention? Jordan Goodman. He's right here on the show, and we'll be right back with more Money Talk, so stick around.
This is Money Talk with Don Soa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we're back with tonight's last segment on the Money Talk program. I'm delighted to have all of you taking your drive time home. Please be careful out there. We do appreciate that. Tune in again tomorrow and each night at 5 o'clock for the Money Talk program with either Steve Bove or Donna Allard, my daughter, or myself right here on AM 790. My guest tonight on the program, Jordan Goodman, in town for lots of different reasons. We mentioned he's a graduate of Moses Brown, and he's in town for a big event down there. A lot of guys survived the Vietnam War that came out of your class. I lost four
we
or five guys.
We were just at the very end. I graduated in 72, so I did get a draft number.
But you were below the level to get called up.
I was below the level to call, luckily. But, yeah, the fall of 72, they were still drafting people, but it was just
I was below the level, although if I had been called, if I was eligible the year before, the numbers came in considerably higher than my number. So I was ready to join the Air Force or the Navy or something. Because I thought they would have been, but I get, and you know, there was a side of me that felt guilty because I had friends and people that I knew that went to Vietnam, even one that didn't survive.
Moses Brown remembers a Quaker school.
Yeah, right.
Became very popular because Quaker, you could be a conscientious objector, right? It didn't work that way. Just going that school does not make you a conscientious objector, but people tried.
Before we came on the air tonight, Jordan, we were talking about the psychology of investing and how a lot of times we invest based either yes or no, good or bad, based on how we feel. So this past week, we've seen that kind of volatility based upon news, political news coming out of Washington, D.C. on any given day. The market suddenly drops 200-300 points in any given day. And then,
I mean, nothing fundamentally had changed, but people's feelings had changed. That's correct.
And, of course, they're speculating about what it all means.
Right. So the stock market took off like a rocket after the election on the hope that President Trump would put through tax reform, deregulation, infrastructure spending, repatriation of foreign profits.
A growth-oriented concept.
That's right. And deregulation he's been doing, because that he can do with an executive pen, and his appointees are deregulating like crazy. Tax reform is really struck, and health care, I'll say, as well. Tax reform is really bogged down, and health care is bogged down as well. So if he is just so consumed by the Comey thing and the special prosecutor and all this kind of swirling stuff, he's not going to get the tax reform and health care and all these things. So that's what hit people yesterday, was maybe everything, the reason the market's gone up is not going to be there. And frankly, I think that's right. I do not think we're going to get tax reform this year. I do not think health care is going to pass, because it is completely partisan. The Democrats will not agree on any whatsoever on health care, will not agree at all on taxes. Now, infrastructure, I think they would agree to some extent. But we're not going to get to that until the others happen.
Now, are they going to consider the repatriation of foreign corporate dollars as part of tax reform?
Yes.
So they won't be.
They can't do that separately.
There'll be no separate standalone bill there.
No. And same with infrastructure. So things are being held up, and health care is going first. Now, it squeaked through the House, but they're basically the Senate starting over again.
Is it your opinion, then, that here we are getting close to the end of May, 5 months into this year? Is it your opinion, then, that a large part of the success that this market has enjoyed so far this year was based on the expectation of success?
Some of it. That's part of it, but also the fundamentals of the companies have been improving.
Yeah.
I mean, in the quarter reports we just had, 72% of the S&P 500 beat estimates. So that's real.
Top and bottom line in some cases.
Yeah. So Amazon and Google and Facebook and Salesforce and Microsoft and Apple, I could go through a whole bunch of companies that are really doing well fundamentally, no matter what's going on in Washington. So there's a fundamental reason why the stock market's gone up. But the initial push was the hope for all the things we just talked about.
It's funny. There was a Nobel Prize-winning economist. He said, you know, Trump and his people keep talking about 4 and 5% GDP growth if they get their programs through and everything else. He said, forget all of that. If we could go from 1.8
to 3, it'd be plenty.
He says, never mind, to 2.5.
Yes.
He says, that extra growth, corporate earnings could grow as much as 25% if you could get an extra half a percent of GDP growth.
That would help. And obviously cutting the corporate tax rate from 35% to 15%, corporate profits would go up, which means the earnings would go up. And even if you had the same multiple on them, the stock would go up a lot because the earnings would just go up because they're paying less in taxes.
So the average investor right now, obviously the problem we have with this discussion is that we don't have the investor sitting in front of us, giving us his balance sheet and telling us all about his financial background. So we can't say this is what you need to do.
Right.
But with all of the rhetoric, you've got a lot of people who are in the same boat on TV and radio saying, well, you know, the market is not cheap anymore. We are at all-time highs.
We are. But, I mean, if you look at how low interest rates are, in fact, they've been falling lately, that means the valuation goes up. When interest rates go down or stay low, that increases the multiple on stocks.
Well, the last crisis period for investors where the market was genuinely expensive, and if I use price-to-earnings multiples, P.E. ratio as the example, would have been late 1999, first quarter of 2000.
2007, it got very high, too. you had the housing boom, and things got pretty overheated in 2007, early 2008 as well, before things started falling.
But we're
not as much as 1999.
So has our global or national credit picture improved based upon that? Because we were at a credit meltdown back in 2008.
Well, we were a credit meltdown. Remember, we almost went off the fiscal cliff in 2011. We've had a lot of crises here we've gotten through. But, yeah, this is a global phenomenon as well. We have, I mean, in fact, the stock markets around the world are doing even better. We're hitting record highs. So far this year, the Dow's up about 14%. Emerging markets are up about 20%. So around the world, it's been happening as
well. So if we're growing since the recession ended in early 2009, if in this last period, 7 or 8 years, they talk about the doldrums, it's been a slow grinding recovery.
Yes.
Is that slow grinding recovery one of the reasons we haven't had a major correction in the market since then?
I think so. I think so. It's like what they call a Goldilocks economy. It's not too hot, not too cold, just right. If it got too hot, if we were growing at 3 or 4%, then you know the Federal Reserve would be raising interest rates to kind of squelch it, right?
Right.
So you have the brake and the accelerator. If Trump puts you on the accelerator too much, then the Fed's going to put on the brake.
Right.
So right now, the Fed's raising rates a little bit, but nothing too aggressive. And as I said, I don't think a lot of Trump's policies are actually going to happen. The tax reform, I think a lot of it's very good, but there is no way on earth the Democrats are going to support any of it. And just contrast the situation right now with the last major tax bill we had in 1986, when Reagan got it through, when he was signing the bill, thank you, Mr. Rostenkowski and Tip O'Neill and Bill Bradley and Gephardt, all these Democrats. It was a bipartisan bill, and it took a year and a half.
Yeah.
That is totally different from the situation we're in right now.
Okay, well, folks, we are at the end. We got a lot more to talk about with Mr. Jordan Goodman. Unfortunately, we don't have the time. But, again, go to his website, please.
MoneyAnswers.com. Glad to take emails from you as well.
Lots of information there. Lots of questions to be answered. And, hey, knows, next time we have on, we're probably going to pick one specific topic and develop it throughout the entire show.
This was a lot of fun.
George, thanks so much for being here.
John. Thank you.
And, by the way, congratulations on the major event over there at Moses Brown.
Very good. Thanks,
folks,
again.
In the meantime, you have a wonderful, wonderful evening, and tune in tomorrow for more Money Talk right here on AM 790. Have a good night.